Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. First up is a blog by Larry Doyle about Elizabeth Warren exposing Wall Street's top banker. How is it that some people are able to aggressively promote the virtues of truth, transparency, and integrity within our financial system, while others would seem to talk a good game but do not truly walk the walk? The key, in my mind, is that the former are not beholden to a constituency focused on short-term maximization of profits and revenues. Who is distinguishing herself as a leader in this category? Elizabeth Warren, the current chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel to investigate the U.S. banking bailout. Warren writes in a recent Wall Street Journal of Wall Street's race to the bottom. This race is very much a function of implementing strategies and developing products that have served to maximize the short-term revenues of these firms while eroding the very foundation of the financial system itself. Of particular interest in Warren's article is her comment on congressional efforts to develop a consumer finance protection effort and the response of Wall Street's CEOs to this effort. Warren derisively singles out J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon, Wall Street's top banker. She writes, "The consumer agency is a watchdog that would root out gimmicks and traps and slim down paperwork, giving families a fighting chance to hang on to some of their money." So far, Wall Street CEOs seem determined to stop any kind of watchdog. They seem to think that they can run their businesses forever without our trust. This is a bad calculation. It is a bad calculation because shareholders suffer enormously from the long-term cost of the boom and bust cycles that accompany a poorly regulated market. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon recently explained this brave new world, saying that crises should be expected every 5 to 7 years. According to Professor Warren, she says, Dimon is wrong. He seems to accept the fact that markets and economies will tend to excess as a normal order of business. The fact is, our economy and markets have ballooned every 5 to 7 years since the late 1980s, but is this normal? No. What drove the ballooning was a willingness and desire on behalf of both borrowers and lenders to implement excessive leverage across a wide array of asset classes, utilizing both sides of the balance sheet and even moving off balance sheet as well. Wall Street pushed the leverage because it drove short-term revenues. Who failed? Wall Street management, Wall Street's boards of directors, regulators of all stripes, including the SEC, the FINRA, the OCC, Office of Comptroller of the Currency, the FHFA, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision. And finally, congressional oversight failed. So according to the blogger, Warren is right and Dimon is wrong. Blaming the market and economy for excesses in the natural ebb and flow of capital is shirking responsibility.
The aforementioned CEOs, boards, and regulators have a responsibility to protect and promote prudent and wise use of capital. If that practice hits short-term profits, so be it. This obligatory prudence is their charge, and it will promote long-term fiscal health and free market capitalism. When will Jamie Dimon and his fellow CEOs, the members of the boards, and the regulators have the strength to call for real transparency and take a stand for true capitalism in the process? America is waiting. And thank you, Elizabeth Warren. And that's Larry Doyle from Sense on Sense.
And from Luke Mullins of the U.S. News and World Report, forget the mortgage, I'm paying my credit card bill. Amid high unemployment and sliding home prices, a growing number of struggling consumers are doing what was once considered unthinkable, paying their credit card bills instead of their mortgages. A recent study developed by TransUnion found the percentage of Americans who are current on their credit cards but behind on their mortgages increased to 6.6% in the third quarter of 2009, up from 4.3% in the first quarter of 2008. Meanwhile, the share of consumers making mortgage payments on time but behind on their credit cards moved in the opposite direction, sliding from 4.1% to 3.6% over the same time period. The data reflects a fundamental paradigm shift in the way consumers prioritize payment of debt obligations, said Ezra Becker of TransUnion. This is dramatically different, he says. It is a clear manifestation of the dynamics that led up to the recession and the recession itself. Before the housing crisis, bankers typically operated under the assumption that homeowners would do whatever possible to remain current on their mortgage, even if that meant falling behind on other bills. It used to be that the mortgage was sacrosanct, says Keith Gumbinger of HSN.com. You pay it before anything else. But a combination of factors linked to the current economic mess, falling home prices, high unemployment, and tight consumer credit, have led many consumers to prioritize credit card payments above mortgage bills. This sort of thing is what keeps bankers awake at night, Gumbinger says. The development is rooted in the housing bust. When home prices turned south, falling roughly 30% from their peak in the second quarter of 2006, a great deal of borrowers watched the value of their homes drop below what they owed on their mortgages. Today, roughly 1 in 4 homeowners finds himself in this position, which is also known as being underwater. Without equity in their homes, such borrowers are more likely to default. They don't see any value in putting money into an asset that has lost that much value and will probably never regain that value to offset the mortgages, says Celia Chen of MoodysEconomy.com. At the same time, the breezy credit standards of the first half of the previous decade worked to reduce the psychological investments that consumers made in their properties, Becker said. A lot of people were able to get their homes with very little down payment or no down payment at all, he said. So there was no real sense of, I worked really hard to achieve home ownership. Instead, achieving home ownership came very easy, Becker says. But while walking away from a mortgage, even at times when borrowers can afford it, has become a less radical prospect, remaining current on a credit card has grown increasingly important for many Americans. First, credit cards can be used to pay for basic necessities like food, gas, or clothes. And with the unemployment rate remaining near double digits, purchasing such items with credit has become more and more essential. At the same time, the tighter credit environment has made credit cards more difficult to obtain, Becker says. So consumers have become increasingly concerned with hanging on to the cards that they have. It is hard to operate in our society without a credit card today, according to Gumbinger. Still, another key factor is the desperate consequences associated with defaulting on a mortgage versus those for falling behind on credit card
National anti-foreclosure efforts have worked to significantly extend the time period between a borrower's initial mortgage default notice and the foreclosure itself, says Edward Pinto, a former chief credit officer at Fannie Mae. The last thing you have to worry about at this juncture is paying your mortgage, because by the time they foreclose, it could be 6 months, 12 months, or a year and a half down the road, according to Pinto. A credit card, however, can disappear much quicker, Becker says. If you go a couple months without paying your credit card bill, they are going to close your account, he says. You won't be able to access your credit. A credit card's ability to finance basic necessities and the swift consequences of default make the trends highlighted in the TransUnion study less startling, especially in a time of high unemployment and widespread negative equity. For a borrower who has got a significant cash shortfall, it is a completely rational decision to pay off a credit card bill while defaulting on a mortgage, Gumbinger says. Still, Becker notes that none of these decisions are simple. When you hear about strategic defaults and people choosing to walk away from their mortgages, nobody is flip or carefree about that, Becker says. Decisions about who you are going to pay and who you are not going to pay are incredibly stressful. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's get into the second segment of the show, where we have been going over the book, The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, which is by Professor Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tiagi. I want to give an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, examples, and concepts in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also revisit all of my shows at the archives, www.kruufm.com. Go under Life and Debt, and you can get a full picture on what we've discussed about how to deal with your debt. Last week, I was talking about the myth of the immoral debtor, and we raised the issue about bankruptcy. Essentially, the myth of the immoral debtor has its variations. There are some people out there, critics, who claim that families have gotten sneakier. Some of these critics are very, very high-level people, like a federal judge, Edith Jones, who asserted that bankruptcy is increasingly seen as a big game, with losers being those who live within their means, while the bankrupts pursue more interesting and carefree lives. Just as an aside, not my experience with debtors. But the thought is that in the good old days, families would work their fingers to the bone to pay off their debts. But today, according to people like Judge Jones, bankruptcy more and more is looked at as an option first rather than last resort. Families could pay their bills, but would rather take the easy way out. So Professor Warren responds to this by saying, let's look at some basic facts about what it means to file for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy offers a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card, essentially. Although the specifics vary, the basic ideas are the same for both corporate and personal bankruptcies. When someone has gotten into serious financial trouble, he may seek protection from his creditors by filing for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy judge supervises the case to ensure that creditors are repaid to the fullest extent possible, while the debtor gets a chance to recover from disaster and take a fresh start. For a business that is failing, the court takes legal jurisdiction over the company's assets and makes every effort to treat the various creditors equitably, which usually means only partial repayment of the outstanding debts. In some cases, such as the high-profile dot-com failures of the early 2000s, the business is shuttered and the assets are sold off piecemeal, with all proceeds parceled out to the various creditors. And in other kind of cases, such as a Kmart or United Airlines case, a portion of the debt is written off and a leaner, restructured company is allowed to continue its operation, and that's a Chapter 11 scenario, while the former was a Chapter 7. Now, for an individual who files bankruptcy, the process is somewhat similar. In theory, the court takes legal control over all the assets, and any assets that are not exempt under federal or state exemption rules, depending on which state one lives in, those assets that are not exempt are liquidated and used to repay creditors to the fullest extent possible. While the exemptions are very important in the bankruptcy process, and they can vary very widely from state to state, facing the bankruptcy is by no means an easy psychological experience for people. With good bankruptcy exemption planning and some help from professionals, it is true that individuals in particular can have a very stable, fresh start, a starting over or a reboot in their lives. But even with this fresh start, there are a number of fundamental debts that are sometimes never forgiven, no matter what. For example, under current law, student loans, alimony, child support, and many kinds of taxes must be paid in full, regardless of how long it takes. Bankruptcy would offer no relief whatsoever. Under most circumstances, there are always exceptions to even these kinds of situations. An individual can file a Chapter 7, which is the straight liquidation bankruptcy that can take place every 8 years, or a Chapter 13, which is a repayment plan. Chapter 7 normally doesn't take more than a few months, whereas a Chapter 13, particularly if one must file a Chapter 13, is 5 years now. In that circumstance, the debtor is buying time in order to pay what he or she owes rather than to get rid of the debts altogether. And in most cases, it's not a choice. One is forced into a Chapter 13 depending on how much money one has left over every month after paying allowable expenses from one's total income. In a Chapter 13, the family works out a repayment plan under which it commits to living on a sharply restricted budget for the next 5 years in most cases, but in some limited cases for 3 or more years by choice, handing over the remainder of each paycheck to a trustee who distributes it among the creditors according to the confirmed plan. Only after the payments are complete can the family discharge any debts that remain unpaid. A few other points that shows that it's not so much of a carefree walk is that families must publicly disclose all their financial dealings, show their personal budgets to creditors, and submit to supervision by a court-appointed trustee. Then, for 10 years, their credit reports will document their bankruptcy, making everything from car insurance to house payments more costly. In some parts of the country, people's names are published in the newspaper. With online searches, the fact of their bankruptcy may pop up when someone tries to find them via the internet. Future employers will discover the bankruptcy if they run a credit check, which is now a routine screening process for many jobs, which can lead to an embarrassing explanation or worse, a lost chance for a much needed job. Also, the family will still owe a large chunk of its debts. It's not that the mortgage payment goes away, the car loan disappears, or the taxes and student loans and so forth, even after filing bankruptcy, just go away. But if a family is willing to go through all that, it can at least have some of its debt erased, no questions asked. And of course, the better the planning with professional help prior to filing bankruptcy, the better off that debtor will be. When one looks at all of these facts and the potential stress from the risks of bankruptcy, it is not correct to say that today's families are using bankruptcy courts more liberally than they used to. The data just doesn't support that argument. If a growing number of people were looking for an easy way out, then we would expect to find that families in bankruptcy today are in relatively better shape than those who filed a generation ago. For example, we might find that they have smaller debt loads relative to their incomes, with the clear implication that at least some of those folks could pay off the debts if they tried a little harder. Instead, just the opposite has happened. Today's bankruptcy families are deeper in debt than their counterparts just 20 years earlier, and their overall financial picture, assets, and debts is worse. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been looking at the concept of the myth of the immoral debtor and looking at some data and some accusations against those who file bankruptcy. If people are more likely to liberally file bankruptcy today, then they would be in relatively better shape than those who filed a generation ago. We would find that they have smaller debt loads relative to their incomes, and the clear implication that at least some of those folks could pay off their debts if they tried a little harder. However, just the opposite has happened. Today's bankrupt families are deeper in debt than their counterparts just 20 years earlier, and their overall financial picture, assets and debts, is worse. For example, in 1981, the median family filing for bankruptcy owed 80% of total annual income in credit card and other non-mortgage debts. By 2001, that figure had nearly doubled to 150% of annual income. Even the credit industry, which has the most to gain from prying a few dollars out of bankrupt families, estimates that only about 10% of families who file for bankruptcy could actually afford to repay even a portion of their discharged debts. Although, according to Professor Warren, independent academics put the number closer to 1 to 2%. But even presuming it's 10%, the remaining 90% are tapped out, too broke for even their creditors to bother with. There are lots of signs that people are not rushing headlong into bankruptcy at the first sign of trouble in their lives. The average person who filed for bankruptcy reports spending more than a year struggling with his debts before filing. Before they finally gave up and filed for bankruptcy, 50% of the families had their utilities or telephone shut off for non-payment, and nearly 60% did without needed medical care in order to save money. Now, these are all figures from Professor Warren's research. She said one in five of these college-educated, home-owning families in bankruptcy said they had done without food at some point before filing because they simply couldn't afford it. By the time they sought refuge in the bankruptcy courts, the average family owed more than an entire year's income in non-mortgage debt. This is certainly not a carefree ride. Moreover, bankruptcy statistics are not the only signs of financial distress. The number of home foreclosures in the last 35 years is, as we've talked about a lot, skyrocketed, with predictions of up to 10 million foreclosures over the last 4 years looking into the next two. And car repossessions has gone off the charts too. So anyone, including federal judges, that think that bankruptcy filings are just a big game is not giving accurate analysis of the situation. A family who no longer has a roof over their heads, we all doubt, is having much fun due to their financial failure. In sum, it really is the case that people do not run into bankruptcy. In fact, people often hesitate, they delay, they come up with all kinds of reasons why they shouldn't file, and they even strain to pay back debt they can ill afford to pay, taking money from basic family needs in order to pay some creditor who may be harassing them and they feel an obligation to pay. The concept that people are carefree or cavalier about filing bankruptcy is quite incorrect. I personally don't think I've ever come across a client who thought that filing bankruptcy was the easy way out. The easy way out being one variation of the immoral debtor. But let's look at another variation of that myth. That variation is that today's families are more willing to lie, cheat, and file for bankruptcy under false pretenses. People like Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah and organizations like the American Bankers Association have put forth that massive numbers of families filing for bankruptcy are engaged in fraud and abuse. This kind of thinking led up to the law that was passed in 2005. One of the primary motives for the law was the belief that it could weed out any fraud and abuse. Now, prior to the new law, courts did go to great lengths to try to prevent fraud and abuse in bankruptcy. If a person wanted to commit fraud through bankruptcy, he would usually try to hide his assets from his creditors, perhaps in an offshore account, a bogus trust, or through transfer to a separate corporation or another person. Very typical kinds of fraud. But in order to prevent this, every single personal bankruptcy filing is accompanied by detailed financial disclosures filed under penalty of perjury, reviewed by a court-appointed trustee, and made public for any creditor or other interested party to scrutinize. Every debtor seeking bankruptcy relief must come to court in person, swear to tell the truth, and submit to cross-examination by the trustee and any creditors who appear. If anything suspicious emerges, the debtor will be ordered back into court by a judge and examined further under oath. Anyone who files a fraudulent bankruptcy petition or misrepresents his circumstances violates federal law and risks prosecution by the Department of Justice. A guilty verdict can result in jail time, and any creditor who can show that a debtor lied on a credit application or otherwise committed fraud can have the debt exempted from discharge in bankruptcy. The creditor is also entitled to file criminal charges. Even if they had evil in their hearts, it would be extremely difficult for the average family in bankruptcy to commit serious fraud. The overwhelming majority of people who file for personal bankruptcy aren't the financial sophisticates one usually associates with Swiss bank accounts and dummy corporations. They are ordinary middle-class families whose total assets consist of a home, a car, and maybe a checking account, plus usual and standard household goods. In Professor Warren's study of more than 2,000 bankrupt families, only one owned a second home, a small rental house that produced income, not a vacation place, and no one had an offshore account or self-settled trust. Nor did these families have a personal attorney on a retainer or a longtime accountant who might be persuaded to do a little finagling on the side. Just the opposite. Most people who filed for bankruptcy never met a lawyer until the mortgage company sent a foreclosure notice, at which point they hired someone whose ad appeared in the Yellow Pages or on a late-night television show. Typically, the attorney spent less than half an hour giving them advice before passing them on to a paralegal who completed the paperwork necessary for the bankruptcy filing. If fraud alone accounted for the increase in the number of bankruptcies over the past generation, then 8 out of every 10 families filing for bankruptcy today would have to be committing fraud. It seems pretty absurd to suggest that over the past decade, roughly 10 million families independently decided that they would commit a felony that could land them in jail and that no one else heard about it. In short, the myth of the immoral debtor might make for good headlines, but like the overconsumption myth, it won't hold up to hard analysis. Are there some families cheating? Of course. Just like there are some families who are over-consuming. Being in financial trouble confers no special state of grace that eliminates all the sharp operators and crafty manipulators who travel among us. But the stark numbers, bankruptcy filings that have quintupled, mortgage foreclosures that have skyrocketed, car repossessions that have become common, cannot be explained away so easily. And next week, we'll take a look at what went wrong. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. You have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083. or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.